Today we start part two of the book, and in the beginning there is a chart about gain-of-function research and the rise of the biosecurity era. And I'm just going to give you an overview of that. It's quite lengthy, the chart. Also, I'm not at home recording this, so I'm in my car at the marina, and you may hear other sounds. I'm hoping it won't be too distracting with other cars and things going on around me. Okay, so here it is, part two, gain of function research and the rise of the biosecurity era. The chart is organized in such a way that it has the year on the left-hand column, the month and day, next column, and then the event. So it's just three columns. So I'm going to start, and it starts at 1997. In 1997, the event was New Rule Allows Drug Advertising Directly to Consumers on American Television. 1998, Microsoft Innovation Lab opens in Beijing, China. 1999, Gates sets up Gavi to induce Western nations to finance vaccines in developing nations. 2001, in June 22nd, Dark Winter tabletop exercise simulates smallpox attack. 2001, in September 11th, U.S. planes hijacked by Islamic terrorists crash into strategic targets. 2001 October, weaponized anthrax sent by mail to media and Senate offices. 2001 October 26th, President George W. Bush signs the Patriot Act, expanding government power over citizens. For me, just as an anecdotal comment here, that, to me, was when everything really started to go downhill. Okay. Anyway, it affected us even in the library. Okay, to continue on, 2002, biodefense spending rapidly spikes to $4 billion. 2002, Barrick and Dennison perfect cloning technique, hijacking bacterial cells to produce large numbers of perfect genetic copies and no-see-em method for genetic manipulation of viruses. 2002, November, SARS appears in Guangdong, China. 2002, China hides information about SARS, allowing it to spread. 2003, March 20, United States enters Iraq War. Second Persian Gulf War. 2003, July 16. Barrick makes first DNA clone of the 2003 SARS virus. 2003, December 22. Federal Judge Emmett G. Sullivan rules that the United States military's anthrax vaccine mandate is illegal. 2004, April 28. President George W. Bush signs biodefense for the 21st century. 2004 May, Pentagon resuscitates its chemical and biological defense program. 2004, Russian scientist dies from lab accident involving Ebola. 2004, construction of the Wuhan Institute of Virology begins. 2004, Xi Zhengli identifies bats as natural reservoirs for SARS virus. 2005, overhyped bird flu pandemic fizzles. 2005, October 28. Daszak and Shi publish bats are natural reservoirs of SARS or SARS like coronaviruses. 2006, numerous SARS infections of previous 3 years are traced to labs. 2006, Congress passes Biodefense and Pandemic Vaccine and Drug Development Act of 2005. 2006, December, Daszak and Shi publish review of bats and SARS. 2007,
foot and mouth disease microbes go missing in the UK, causing the slaughter of hundreds of farm animals. 2008, Thousand Talents Program is launched by Chinese government. 2008, NIAID, or NIAID, grants $2.6 million to EcoHealth to study bat pathogens. 2008, August 6th, FBI blames Fort Detrick biodefense researcher Bruce Ivins for anthrax attacks of 2001. 2009, researcher in Chicago dies from laboratory-cultivated plague. 2009, USAID launches PREDICT, program to identify viruses with pandemic potential, begins funding Wuhan lab through EcoHealth Alliance. 2010, swine flu pandemic fizzles with fewer flu deaths than normal. 2012, postdoc in San Francisco dies of lab infection. 2012, August, NIAID, or NIAID, gives $21.7 million to Ralph Barrick for biodefense pathogen research. 2013, Hualan Shen engineers H1N1 to infect humans. Sorry, I'm getting distracted. There's all kinds of pigeons and geese and everything flying around here right now. Sorry. Okay. All right, back to the text. 2014 March. Three high-profile biosecurity breaches occur at U.S. labs. 2014 October. President Obama declares a moratorium on gain-of-function research. 2014 October 21st, NIH issues 18 cease and desist letters to gain-of-function projects. 2014, PREDICT and China co-fund study to search for coronavirus strains with zoonosis and weapons potential. 2015 March, Bill Gates gives TED Talk, warning that the catastrophes of our time are not missiles, but microbes, quote unquote. Are, quote, not missiles, but microbes, end quote. 2015, Ralph Barrick brings Xi's bat coronavirus, SCH-014, to life in his lab. 2015, PREDICT awards grant to Wuhan researchers for research on bat coronaviruses. 2015, Barrick and Xi collaborate on a SARS-like cluster of circulating bat coronaviruses shows potential for human emergence using Barrick's genetic manipulation methods. 2017, January 9, potential pandemic pathogen care and oversight, or P3CO, framework is developed. 2017, January 10, Dr. Anthony Fauci predicts pandemic during the Trump administration. 2017, January 18, Gates launches CEPI at the World Economic Forum. 2017, Emory begins gain-of-function research on avian flu. 2017, December 19, moratorium on gain-of-function research ends. 2017, Chinese scientists at the WIV use Barrick's quote-unquote no-see-em method to create chimeric coronaviruses. 2018, January, Chinese government appoints Xi Zhengli, principal investigator of genetic evolution and transmission mechanism of important bat-borne viruses. 2018, January 19, United States Embassy in Beijing cables State Department warning that BSL-4 lab in Wuhan is deficient for study of pathogens. 2018, BSL-4 lab at Wuhan Institute of Virology opens for work. 2018, Gates raises major funds to develop rapid vaccine creation technologies. 2018 March, EcoHealth's defuse proposal suggests gain-of-function experiments involving adding a furin cleavage site to SARS and MERS viruses, or MERS, I guess it's MERS, SARS and MERS viruses. 2018, NIH reviewers renew EcoHealth grant after Daszak admits work at the Wuhan lab will not be supervised. 2018, April 27, Gate warns of urgency when it comes to biological threats. 2018, NIAID, or NIAID, provides training of Chinese scientists at the Galveston BLS-4 lab. 2018, June 12th, EcoHealth Alliance joins Microsoft's AI for Earth program. 2018, Wuhan scientists create synthetic virus that replicates 10,000 times faster in human cells than natural virus. 2019, Dennis Carroll and Peter Daszak set up Global Virome Project. 2019, January 18, WHO declares vaccine hesitancy one of the 10 greatest threats to public health. 2019, February, Representative Adam Schiff calls for censorship of vaccine misinformation, quote-unquote vaccine misinformation. 2019, March, Wuhan scientist predicts probable coronavirus pandemic. 2019, March 28th, Moderna seeks patent approval for coronavirus vaccine platform. Is that the end of that? Yeah, that's the end of that. Okay, so that was your chart as the opening of part two of the book. Gives you a brief history of how this thing has escalated out and how long it's been going on. Chapter 16, The Anthrax Attack, Birth of the Biosecurity Agenda. Historians date the nativity of the modern biosecurity agenda to the anthrax attacks that began in September of 2001. But years earlier, military and medical industrial complex planners were already conceptualizing biosecurity as a potent strategy for leveraging potential pandemics into vast funding increases and as a device for metamorphosing America into a national security state with global dominance. Following the 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union, politicians promised Americans a quote-unquote peace dividend. We would finally beat our swords into plowshares, diverting the monies formerly spent on billion-dollar stealth bombers that couldn't fly in the rain to education, transportation, healthcare, police, and a clean environment. In short, we would rebuild the public infrastructure necessary to restore an American middle class gutted by 50 years of Cold War military spending. While most Americans eagerly awaited the ballyhooed peace dividend, Pentagon mandarins and their emporium of contractors and allies in multinational corporations and intelligence agencies, not to mention neocon allies like Scooter Libby, PNAC founder Robert Kagan and his wife, Victoria Nuland, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, and John Bolton, considered with dismay that someone else would be spending money and wielding power that was rightfully theirs. Terrified by the prospect of forfeiting its revenue stream, the military-industrial complex began rummaging about for a more reliable enemy to permanently justify its hefty share of the GDP. Despite the numerous warnings by America's founders that democracy at home was incompatible with imperialism abroad, quote, but she, America, goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy, end quote, said John Quincy Adams, the lure of monopolistic control of the developing world's markets and natural resources has long captured the imagination of America's military panjandrums and corporate mandarins. At the insistence of President Franklin Roosevelt, the reluctant British Prime Minister Winston Churchill had, in 1941, signed the Atlantic Charter as a condition for the United States' support during World War II. That idealistic and anti-imperialist document forced the Allied nations to pledge to release their colonies following the war. While more than 50 African, Asian, and European nations eventually achieved independence following the peace treaties, the United States military and intelligence agencies, allied with U.S. corporations, soon moved to resubjugate these countries with a so-called, quote, soft colonialism, end quote. The Cold War rationalized the presence of the Pentagon and the United States intelligence agencies in virtually every developing nation as a barrier against brushfire rebellions by local malcontents conveniently branded as communist. By the Cold War's end in 1991, the United States had some 800 military bases in over 70 countries, a presence that fostered reliance on the United States military by local political leaders and oligarchies, and facilitated access by U.S. corporations to the rich natural resources in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Along with derailing the peace dividend, the persistent objective of the military-industrial complex has been to maintain those territorial acquisitions. The World Trade Center bombing in 1993, only a year after the Soviet collapse, effectively rescued the military-industrial complex from the accursed peace dividend and made Islamic terrorism the new bugaboo. That incident laid the foundation stone for the costly erection of the American surveillance state. Islamic terrorism replaced the Soviets as the essential adversary in United States foreign policy, justifying the Cold War magnitude, military budgets, and the continued American military presence in Europe and across the developing world. It may have provided solace to the military and its contractors that terrorism was a more reliable long-term foe than the Soviet Union. Terrorism, after all, is a tactic, not a nation. It is, in short, an enemy that could never be vanquished. We can imagine the defense contractor's relief when Vice President Dick Cheney declared the quote-unquote long war, one he promised that would last for generations in battlegrounds scattered in more than 50 nations. Sorry, I don't know if that was read right. When we can imagine that the defense contractor's relief when Vice President Dick Cheney declared the long war, one he promised that would last for generations in battlegrounds scattered in more than 50 nations. Military contractors held tight to their gravy train with the patriotic mission of building an expensive new arsenal of anti-terror technologies. But Islamic terrorism has had its own shortfall, namely the challenge of sustaining public fear sufficient to justify spending substantial portions of GDP to meet a threat that killed fewer Americans annually than lightning strikes. By 1999, some far-sighted Pentagon planners were already looking ahead to the more exuberant and sustainable prosperity that would come with a war on germs. While most Americans would have only the most remote chance of directly suffering an Islamic terrorist attack on their community, almost anyone could be induced through appropriate propaganda to fear that a malevolent germ could enter their homes and slay their families. This more reliable and terrifying enemy would soon replace the war against Islamic terror, justifying a quote-unquote forever war against germs. Biosecurity, also known as pandemic preparedness and response, or PPR, provided a rationale for United States presence in every developing nation. Viruses filled the need for a frightening and monstrous villain to justify continued military and police state interventions, expansions, and expenditures. The emerging medical military-industrial complex would soon be citing biosecurity as a pretext for centralized control, coordinated response among nations, a sprawling construction project for new U.S. bioweapons laboratories, the archiving of every germ with weapons potential under the pretext of pandemic protection, the control of the media, the imposition of censorship, the erection of an unprecedented surveillance infrastructure ostensibly needed to, quote-unquote, track and trace infections, universal digital IDs, digital currencies to reduce disease spread, and the ceding of power by national governments to the WHO, in short, globalism. The beneficiaries would be the coalition behind the PPR industrial complex, military and intelligence agencies, social media titans, national banks, big data, and big pharma. The new behemoths that would soon have revenues, launching them to the top of the Fortune 500. The biosecurity agenda provided a rationale for centralized global control by billionaires and a technological elite, an outcome promoted by the World Economic Forum and Munich Security Conference. The September 2001 anthrax attacks provided the impetus for the emergence of biosecurity as a potent instrument of United States global hegemony and the resurrection of the bioweapons arms race. The principal architect of the biosecurity agenda was George W. Bush's vice president, the neocon Mahatma, Dick Cheney, who, alongside his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Paul Wolfowitz, laid the groundwork for the emergence of biosecurity as the spear tip of American foreign policy. Rise of the neocons. The George W. Bush administration represented the apogee of influence for the warmongering neocons, who had dominated the Reagan White House and then suffered exile during the Clinton era. In 1997, these Republican neocon ideologues, including Cheney, Rumsfeld, Libby, and Wolfowitz, along with former Assistant Attorney General John Bolton, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy Richard Perle, and Robert Kagan, organized a think tank named the Project for the New American Century, or PNAC, PNAC. Libby's White House colleagues dubbed him Germ Boy because of his aggressive promotion of the biowarfare agenda, including his authorship of a 1996 novel, The Apprentice, about a group of travelers stranded in a remote inn in Japan due to a smallpox outbreak. PNAC served as the neocons' jingoistic blueprint for American ascendancy to global domination. 13 of PNAC's 25 founding members served in George W. Bush's White House. Unabashed war hawks, the White House neocons dubbed themselves the Vulcans. Critics called them the chicken hawks because virtually all of these warmongers had dodged the draft during the Vietnam War, which they had all supported. Not surprisingly, they were also advocates of the unrestricted use of police power, including surveillance at home and torture abroad. The unleashing of the United States' energies in the field of bioweapons research and the resurrection of the biosecurity agenda to achieve world domination were enduring features of PNAC's pipe dreams. PPR became the new face of the two-sided coin previously known as imperialism and colonialism. Dark Winter. The official advent of the biosecurity agenda occurred on June 22, 2001, 6 months before 9/11, and with that, in retrospect, seemed a feat almost miraculous prescience. America's leading PPR promoters, including representatives from CIA and NIAID, or NIAID, the Neocon Kahunas, and the New York Times reporter Judith Miller, staged a highly publicized simulated biological attack on the United States. They codenamed the exercise Dark Winter. The principal guru of the pandemic simulations was the bioweapons zealot Robert P. Kedlick, who staged two tabletop exercises in the late 1990s simulating biological attacks on American agriculture. Kedlick was an intelligence asset and retired colonel in the United States Air Force who had managed the COVID-19 crisis during the Trump administration and as Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services for Preparedness and Response from August 2017 until January 2021. As a reminder, this is all footnoted, and this is footnote number 14. So you can always look up everything he says in his book. It's all really footnoted well. Continuing with the text. In The Real Anthony Fauci, I chronicled Kedlick's corrupt relationship with his patrons and business partners, the El Hebri, whose company Bioport, now Emergent Biosolutions, thanks to Kedlick's intervention, received government monopolies on anthrax and smallpox vaccines from the strategic national stockpile that Kedlick conceived and moved into his own agency. Kedlick made the El Hebri major financial beneficiaries in the early days of the biosecurity era. With Kedlick's help, they naturally expanded their lucrative vaccine franchises during the COVID pandemic. Despite chronic ineptitude, Emergent Biosolutions received the largest franchise for manufacturing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, second only to his longtime crony and comrade in arms, Anthony Fauci. Robert Kedlick played a historic leadership role in fomenting the contagious logic that infectious disease posed a national security threat, requiring a militarized response. Since the 1993 World Trade Center terror attack, Kedlick had been evangelizing about an imminent anthrax attack that would doom the American way of life. In the mid-1990s, Kedlick served as a part of an elite Air Force operations unit of UN weapons inspectors, fruitlessly searching the Iraqi desert for Saddam Hussein's suspected stores of anthrax and botulinum following the first Persian Gulf War. If not for the tragic consequences of his actions, Kedlick could be a Dr. Strangelove knockoff with his deep ties to spy agencies, Big Pharma, the Pentagon, and military contractors who profiteer from the spread of bioweapons alarmism. Intelligence agency historian and journalist Whitney Webb describes Kedlick as a man enmeshed in the world of intelligence, military intelligence, and corporate corruption, dutifully fulfilling the vision of his friends in high places and behind closed doors. In 1998, Kedlick created an internal strategy paper for the Pentagon promoting the development of pandemic pathogens as stealth weapons that the Pentagon could deploy against its enemies without leaving fingerprints. Here's a quote. Biological weapons under the cover of an endemic or natural disease occurrence provides an attacker the potential for plausible denial. Biological warfare's potential to create significant economic losses and consequent political instability, coupled with plausible denial, exceeds the possibilities of any other human weapon. Since he played a central role in designing its architecture, laying the groundwork for its emergence, the entire PPR enterprise should be understood in the context of this memo. In June 2001, a group of Kedlick's close colleagues associates and CIA spooks staged the Dark Winter simulation at Andrews Air Force Base near Washington, D.C. Dark Winter participants included former CIA Director James Woolsey and Frank Wisner, a diplomat and Mideast expert, whose father, Frank Wisner Sr., co-founded the CIA and directed its most violent and deadly operations before his suicide in 1965. Tara O'Toole co-scripted Dark Winter. O'Toole, another CIA spook and pharmaceutical industry lobbyist, is a senior fellow and executive vice president of InQtel, the CIA's investment fund, and co-founder and former director of the Gates and NIH-funded Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Strategies, now called the Center for Health Security. Oh, my goodness. That has three footnotes. Let me read that again. That just seems so... Tara O'Toole co-scripted Dark Winter. O'Toole, another CIA spook and pharmaceutical industry lobbyist, is a senior fellow and executive vice president of InQtel, the CIA's investment fund, and co-founder and former director of the Gates and NIH-funded Johns Hopkins Center for Civilian Biodefense Strategies, now called the Center for Health Security. Senator Sam Nunn played the United States president in the Dark Winter simulation, which took place 5 months after he co-founded the Nuclear Threat Initiative, or NTI. NTI's noble objective was to keep Soviet weaponeers and scientists out of the hands of hostile states and terror groups following the collapse of communism. In the early 2000s, NTI played a less idealistic role as the contemporary iteration of Operation Paperclip, working for DTRA, DARP, and the Cooperative Threat Reduction, CTR, Michael Callahan recruited the former Soviet Union's bioweapon scientists and hijacked their pathogen collections for pharmaceutical companies in the United States bioweapons enterprise. Other Dark Winter participants included Dr. Kadlec's fellow National War College professor in bioweapons, Panjandrum, Colonel Randall Larson, United States Air Force, and Margaret Hamburg, then an assistant director of NIAID, and deputy to Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is also a founding vice president and senior scientist of NTI, who played the part of Secretary of Health and Human Services. 21 years later, Nunn and Hamburg would also play key roles at the NTI's shocking prophetic monkeypox simulation at the 2021 Munich Security Conference. Just as a real anthrax attack occurred immediately after the Dark Winter simulation, the WHO declared the 2022 monkeypox emergency on a timeline precisely predicted by the NTI simulation down to the very month, May of 2022. Equally astonishing, in the CIA's two coronavirus pandemic simulations, Crimson Contagion in May 2019 and Event 2001 in October 2019, precisely predicted the COVID-19 pandemic. Finally, the New York Times warmongering yellow journalist Judith Miller played herself in Dark Winter. Miller was an inveterate neocon booster, bioweapons promoter, and the author of 2002 book Germs, which makes the case for United States resurrection of the bioweapons arms race. Biosecurity expert and pharmaceutical entrepreneur Jerome Hauer played the FEMA director. The Gates-funded Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security hosted Dark Winter, The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation helped launch the Johns Hopkins Center and has donated over $1 billion to its operations since 1997. NIH has given some $4 billion to Johns Hopkins University. Dark Winter simulated a smallpox attack against the United States by Iraq's leader, clearly Saddam Hussein. Over the next 2 months, the participants of that simulation, particularly Jerome Hauer and Judith Miller, mounted far-reaching filibusters on the Sunday morning talk show circuit, warning Americans about an impending biological attack and pointing their fingers at Saddam Hussein. The Dark Winter simulation, combined with Hauer and Miller's barnstorming crusade, were so successful in garnering media attention that they prompted highly publicized hearings by two separate Senate committees. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee convened the first of the hearings, quote, "the threat of bioterrorism and spread of infectious diseases, end quote, 6 days before the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks on September 5th, 2001. Committee Chairman Senator Joe Biden presided. Committee Chairman Senator Joe Biden presided. Biden was a rare Democrat war hawk who would champion the first Gulf War and whose son Hunter would later make a fortune by winning Pentagon contracts and preferential treatment from Ukraine's CIA-installed government for his bioweapons contractor Metabiota. Metabiota would earn vast sums from the United States government to build and maintain a string of bioweapons labs in Ukraine and Georgia. Metabiota would also partner with Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance and the CIA cutout USAID, funding virus discovery and virus gain-of-function studies at the Wuhan lab. Chairman Biden convinced several of the Dark Winter participants to testify as witnesses at his hearing. The committee's minority leader, Senator Bill Frist, while officially representing Tennessee, was so ardent at promoting pharmaceutical interests that his colleagues dubbed him, quote, "the senator from Eli Lilly," end quote. Frist was a physician who rode to office on a tsunami of Eli Lilly cash and his family's ownership of Hospital Corporation of America. Democrats accused him of surreptitiously attaching an addendum to the Patriot Act, the so-called Eli Lilly rider, which immunized pharmaceutical companies from liability for injuries caused by mercury-laden vaccines. At the hearing's outset, Frist declared that any threat to the security of the people of the United States from a weapon of mass destruction, including biological weapons, must be taken seriously. In a striking coincidence, those hearings began only 6 days before the 9/11 attacks and only 15 days before news desks at CBS, NBC, ABC, The New York Post, and the National Enquirer began receiving envelopes containing a fine white powder of highly weaponized anthrax spores. Beginning on September 18th, even as Senator Biden conducted his hearings with the nation on high alert from the World Trade Center attacks, someone began mailing weapons-grade anthrax to those United States media companies. The anthrax attacks did not make the press until staffers in the congressional office of Senator Patrick Leahy opened similar powder-filled envelopes postmarked October 9, 2001, followed by those addressed to Senator Tom Daschle, postmarked October 15, 2001. Those mailings constituted the deadliest bioterrorist attack against our country in its 230-year history. 22 people became infected and 5 died.
Millions of Americans suffered anthrax anxiety, and the hundreds of thousands of the worried well flooded the nation's healthcare system. More than 50,000 took broad spectrum antibiotics. Many others purchased antibiotics for future prophylaxis. The anthrax attacks, let me make sure this is still recording here. I think it is, yeah. The anthrax attacks became public as yet another Senate committee, the Senate Appropriations Committee, convened separate secret hearings on bioterrorism. Senator Robert Byrd chaired those hearings between October 3rd and November 29, 2001. If someone had planned a propaganda campaign to frighten the public about bioterrorism in order to push through passage of malevolent and self-serving legislation, the Patriot Act, in a period of orchestrated hysteria, they couldn't have executed it more brilliantly. The witnesses at the Byrd hearing included many of the same medical, military, industrial complex mandarins who, 22 years later, would make their triumphant push for the biosecurity agenda during the COVID-19 crisis. Among those luminaries was Bob Kramer of the L. Hebrises company, Bioport. Other witnesses included executives from the nation's leading vaccine developers, including Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, now Pfizer, emissaries from pharma trade association groups, NIAID or NIAID director Anthony Fauci, and biowarfare expert James DeLuc, both of whom would disgrace themselves in 2020 by colluding with Chinese scientists affiliated with the People's Liberation Army to conceal critical information about COVID's origins from the United States Congress. The Second Gulf War. Dark winter and the subsequent House and Senate hearings laid the foundation for the CIA and its neocon allies to falsely blame the anthrax attacks on Saddam Hussein and to use those attacks as the justification for waging the Iraq invasion. PNAC's founder, Robert Kagan, stoked the hysteria by co-authoring an entirely fabricated article in the Weekly Standard with Bill Kristol, falsely claiming that Saddam was hosting non-Iraqi Islamic terrorists at a training camp in Iraq, complete with a Boeing 707 for practicing hijacking. Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, would emerge in 2022 as chief architect of the Ukrainian war. President Bush later said his worst mistake as president was believing CIA Director George Tenet's assurances that Saddam's possession of weapons of mass destruction was a quote-unquote slam dunk. Years later, the New York Times made an unprecedented apology for the critical role its jingoistic, stunningly deceptive and irresponsible reporting played during the Gulf War rollout. The author of this yellow journalism was the Times warmongering star reporter Judith Miller. As I show in The Real Anthony Fauci, Miller had deep ties to the CIA and the neocons and later went to jail for her part in an illegal caper to out a deep cover CIA spy, Valerie Plame, as part of a neocon scheme to intimidate and punish Plame's husband, diplomat Joe Wilson, who had publicly questioned the CIA's key intelligence assessments that Saddam was purchasing uranium yellow cake from Niger for processing into a dirty bomb. White House neocons, led by Vice President Dick Cheney, had offered this fake intelligence as the principal justification for the United States to invade Iraq and a nation that had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks and was not providing refuge or support for Islamic terrorists. Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Germboy Libby, a neocon messiah, also went to prison for his role as the plot's mastermind. Osama bin Laden, the author of the World Trade Center attacks, supposedly directed that operation from an Afghan cave. But Don Rumsfeld complained, quote, "There aren't any good targets in Afghanistan," end quote. The Peanut chicken hawks were determined to use 9/11 as a pretext for a war against Iraq. Anthrax provided that provocation. U.S. control of Iraq's oil resources was, for PNAC, a key stepping stone for the coming century of American imperialism, and a bioweapon attack against America became the ideal provocation for preemptive invasion. The Patriot Act. Dark winter also set the stage for the blitzkrieg passage of the 342-page Patriot Act. Somehow that bill was written and waiting for its crisis, said Francis Boyle. The neocons took it off the shelf the day after 9/11 and rammed it to passage in both houses in just 45 days. Dennis Kucinich, who served in Congress at that time, told me, quote, "They broke congressional protocols by not providing congressional officers with copies of the bill. The only version supplied was at the clerk's office. In the bill form, it was double-spaced, so it was around 700 pages. I sped read it. Well, it says I speed read it, not sped read it. Anyway, I speed read it. I can guarantee you that I was the only member of Congress to read it. I realized it was not the same bill we debated in committee. They had switched it out after the debate. It was all sleight of hand. I recognized at once that the act was an all-out attack on our Constitution. It dismantled America's most important values and opened the door for the surveillance state. It gave all these new terrible new powers to the FBI and intelligence agencies to spy on Americans and ignore the Bill of Rights. I tried to raise the alarm. No one wanted to hear about it. They had been intellectually and ethically disabled by 9/11. Everyone wanted to be on record having done something patriotic, so they all just decided to believe that the Patriot Act was what it pretended to be." End quote. The total cost of America's bobbled response to 9/11 and the anthrax attacks was $8 trillion, including $2.3 trillion for the Afghanistan-Pakistan war and $4.1 trillion to erect the surveillance infrastructure for America's new national security state. According to a Brown University study, some 800,000 humans died in those conflicts and the subsequent wars in Syria and Yemen, which flowed directly from America's anthrax 9/11 response. Some 2 million Iraqi and Syrian refugees flooded northward, leading to Brexit, the rise of right-wing nationalism, and the destabilization of democracy across Europe. In short, the anthrax attacks engineered an unprecedented shift of national wealth to the priorities of the CIA and its allies in the military-industrial complex that was unrivaled in its monetary costs and its diminution of democracy until the COVID pandemic of 2020. In yet another uncanny coincidence, the primary targets of the anthrax attacks were the two liberal senators, Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, who were leading the Senate fight to derail the speedy passage of the Patriot Act. In addition, on June 21, 2001, Senate Majority Leader Daschle had co-written a letter with House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, expressing their concern about the continued use of the anthrax vaccine in the military. Quote, "In light of the questions surrounding the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine and the inability of the vaccine manufacturer to obtain FDA approval, many have asked why the Pentagon has not halted the vaccination program for all military personnel until these outstanding questions are satisfactorily addressed." End quote. Colonel Thomas Buzz Rempfer, one of the most stalwart activists fighting the military's anthrax vaccine mandate, was actually on the phone with Daschle's office when the anthrax letter delivered
delivery occurred, the anthrax attack effectively ended Daschle's opposition to the anthrax vaccine as post-attack fears reinvigorated the dying vaccine program. After Daschle's office opened an anthrax-containing letter on October 15, United States Capitol Police closed the Capitol for a week. The House passed the Patriot Act on October 11. The Senate on October 24. Bush signed the bill on October 26. The anthrax attacks conveniently shut Congress down during a critical period in American history, when our legislators should have been carefully debating both the Iraq invasion and the Patriot Act. The act therefore passed with almost no congressional input. The act plowed under constitutional privacy and due process rights and ushered in unprecedented powers for federal police and spy agencies to surveil every communication among Americans and to detain United States citizens without due process, things that had been previously illegal. One of the act's many shocking provisions ended both the constitutional prohibition against warrantless searches and the statutory ban for forbidding the CIA from spying on Americans. The Patriot Act altered and expanded the definition of terrorism to include any support, financial or otherwise, of groups deemed quote-unquote terrorist under the expanded definitions. It's important to note here that during the COVID-19 pandemic, the United States Department of Homeland Security for a time expanded the definition of quote-unquote terrorism to include vaccine hesitancy, which included opposition to vaccine mandates and criticism of other government policies on vaccination. In other words, I and millions of other law-abiding and patriotic Americans suddenly became quote-unquote terrorists, subject to the panoply of constitutional abuses provided for in the Patriot Act. Scrapping the Geneva Protocol and the Bioweapons Convention. Furthermore, neocons snuck inserted language into the Patriot Act that effectively nullified the Geneva Protocol and the entire Biological Weapons Convention by expanding the allowable uses of biological weapons under the United States Biological Weapons Statute. Specifically, Section 817 of the Patriot Act, the so-called expansion of the Biological Weapons Statute, added bona fide research to the list of activities that are expressly exempt from the Biological Weapons Statute's prohibitions against developing, producing, stockpiling, transferring, acquiring, retaining, or possessing biological weapons. Additionally, Section 817 added a new prohibition to the statute against possessing any biological agent, toxin, or delivery system. But this prohibition exempts such possession when the type or quantity of substance is, quote, reasonably justified by a prophylactic, protective, bona fide, or other peaceful purpose, end quote. And nowhere does the Biological Weapons Statute or the Patriot Act define or limit the term bona fide research. With this gaping loophole, the United States effectively repealed the BWC, in both its letter and spirit. The Patriot Act gave the military and intelligence agencies a quote-unquote blank check for bioweapons and relaunched the bioweapons arms race Nixon had tried to end, igniting the explosion in gain-of-function science. Even before the anthrax attacks, the neocons had begun dismantling the despised bioweapons treaty. The Clinton administration had negotiated a verification protocol that required BWC signatories, including the United States, to participate in good faith negotiations of enforcement and verification procedures that would finally give teeth to the Biological Weapons Convention. Then, in the aftermath of the Dark Winter simulation, in December of 2001, the Bush administration issued a statement by neocon sachem John Bolton, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, signaling party leadership's plan to officially repudiate the verification protocol for the Biological Weapons Convention. Quote, "The neocons in Bolton torpedoed it at the first available opportunity," end quote, says Boyle, who wrote the United States domestic implementing legislation for the original treaty. "The Bioweapons Convention has been dead as a dodo bird since they scrapped the verification protocol, so that the United States could continue with its offensive biological weapons program, the treaty became a mere scrap of paper." Who was really behind the anthrax attacks? The FBI rapidly determined that the material mailed to two senators and five media companies was the Ames strain of the anthrax, among the most virulent strains known, which was widely distributed at U.S. biolabs. The FBI announced a breakthrough in the case in 2008, using a new way to analyze the anthrax samples from around the country. Investigators had traced the anthrax to the biowarfare lab at Fort Detrick, Maryland, which the CIA and the Pentagon co-manage, and were closing in on a suspect. On a suspect 72, the FBI's suspect Bruce Ivins, a microbiologist and vaccinologist who was a senior biodefense researcher, conveniently took his own life after being told he would be charged with the crime, thereby ending the FBI's investigation and effectively removing suspicion from anyone else lurking in these labs 73-74. Many leading American politicians, including Senator Patrick Leahy, one of the most prominent targets of the attacks, Senator Chuck Connolly, Senator Arlen Specter, Congressman Rush Holt, and several other prominent American leaders, challenged the FBI story that Ivins was solely responsible for the attacks. Reports by a National Academy of Sciences committee and the Government Accountability Office both challenged the FBI's conclusion in its Amerithrax report that it had been made by an Army scientist at Fort Detrick. In response, the FBI requested that the National Academy of Sciences evaluate the FBI case. The NASEM panel expressed skepticism that the FBI findings proved the anthrax came from Ivins' store at Fort Detrick. Many people considered Ivins a patsy in a monumental government cover-up of a false flag event that launched the modern security state, says Dr. Merle Nass. Francis Boyle and many other critics suspect the FBI, and particularly its chemist, Christian Hassel, a longtime protege of bioweapons guru Robert Kadlec and close confidant of Anthony Fauci, of orchestrating a cover-up. Boyle points out that the FBI authorized the destruction of the United States government's anthrax culture collection held at Ames, Iowa. This decision was further evidence, says Boyle, of the FBI's willing participation in the anthrax cover-up. Quote, "The trail of genetic evidence would have led directly back to a secret but officially sponsored United States government biowarfare program that was illegal and criminal," end quote. As part of its ongoing cover-up, according to Boyle, the FBI went out and retained virtually every independent life scientist as part of its fictitious investigation and then swore them all to secrecy. Secrecy, Boyle adds. This may be why there is nothing but an FBI-imposed, quote-unquote, deafening silence coming from the United States life scientist community on the anthrax attacks, except for a few courageous and independently minded individuals. Oh, and one more thing. 2 years earlier,
the Pentagon launched a top secret program called Project Bacchus at a former nuclear test site in the Nevada desert to develop a home anthrax production facility built from off-the-shelf hardware store equipment. Critics suggested that military leaders may have intended their garage germ factory to be used in a false flag event to blame anthrax attacks on a terrorist group. The Pentagon has offered no legitimate explanation as to why it needed to spend black budget dollars to create a low-tech anthrax plant. The triumph of the biosecurity agenda. When the neocons in control, bioweapons mavens began emerging from their long exile to promote germs as the future of warfare and the key to Americans' global hegemony. On an April 2002 blueprint by Air War College alumnus Colonel Michael J. Ainsco of United States Air Force Counterproliferation Center, enthused that new breakthroughs in genetic engineering and synthetic biology could allow the Pentagon to weaponize contagion and maximize killing potential beyond the wildest dreams of earlier bioweapons mavens. Marveling at the lethality of the Spanish influenza, which killed between 20 and 50 million people in 1918, Ainscow giddily mused, quote, "What if a country could create a biological agent that could yield the same catastrophic loss of life on the enemy?" End quote. In an essay published 6 months after the anthrax attacks, Ainscow gushed, "The revolution in molecular biology and biotechnology can be considered as a potential revolution in military affairs, RMA. Ainscow pointed out that new techniques of molecular genetics, genome sequencing, and gene splicing therapy have the potential to endow pathogens with a higher transmissivity, communicability, or antibiotic resistance, and that such tailoring of classical pathogens could make them harder to detect, diagnose, and treat. In effect, they could be more militarily useful." In 1998, Stanford professor Stephen Block, a member of the CIA Technology Consulting Group, JASIN, which promotes synthetic biology and other forms of advanced bioweapons development, echoed Ainscow's enthusiasm for the exciting advances available from genetically engineered pathogens. They could be made safer to handle, easier to distribute, capable of ethnic specificity, or be made to cause higher morbidity or mortality rates. Ainscow explained that the black biology of biotechnology allows the manipulation of genes to create new pathogenic characteristics, increased survivability, infectivity, virulence, drug resistance, etc. Sorry, my phone is dropping all over the place. I hope that's not picked up by the... Okay, let's go back to the text. We're almost finished with this chapter. Organisms with altered characteristics are the next generation biological weapons. He described how gain-of-function studies using cloning and designer genes can be used to create biological weapons that may resist all known therapies, and concluded that the next generation of biological weapons made possible through genetic engineering will be asymmetric weapons par excellence. While academic theoreticians like Ainscow and Block were rhapsodizing about this grim future, one man had already distinguished himself as NIAID's dark puppeteer, manipulating those who would assist him in soon making those nightmare fantasies a reality. Just 2 years earlier, Dr. Anthony Fauci's NIAID had funded a study conducted by Lily Kuo that provided proof that scientists could weaponize harmless to people animal pathogens by manipulating them to infect humans. That is the end of chapter 16. That was quite a lengthy one. I hope you're still with me. Next time will be chapter 17, and the title of the chapter is
Enter Dr. Anthony Fauci.
As an aside here, I feel like this chapter 16 was very important. It really gives you the background and what happened with our surveillance state, the wars, the Patriot Act. I mean, I think this is really, really well written and sourced. I'm going to have to go back and listen to it myself because I think there's so much to digest in this chapter. So I hope you listen. I hope you're learning. I am. And I'll see you on the next podcast when Dr. Anthony Fauci enters the picture of the book. We're getting into the thick of it. Take care.